Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We have current events, which this week have bled into politics. So we're going to have a lot more politics than usual. But first, we're going to start off non-political. Robert Redford dies at 89. The All-American actor and Oscar winner had a second act as a director and founder of the Sundance Film Festival. This is by Julie Miller on September 16th. Robert Redford, the All-American actor whose discontent at being considered just a movie star stirred him to become an Oscar-winning director, environmental activist, and savior of thoughtful cinema with his Sundance Film Festival, died on Tuesday. He was 89. His death was announced by Cindy Berger, chief executive of the publicity firm RNCMPK, who said that Rob Redford had died at his home but did not give a specific cause. One of the most iconic actors of the 20th century American cinema, Redford's resume reads like a film school syllabus, filled with titles like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, The Candidate, Jeremiah Johnson, The Sting, The Way We Were, All the President's Men, Ordinary People, and Out of Africa. Even decades after making those classics, Redford proved his dramatic endurance and all-encompassing commitment to acting in J.C. Chander's gripping one-man 2013 survival epic, All Is Lost. Redford took on the project, the most physically demanding role of his career while he was in his mid-70s, and did most of his own stunts, which led to him partially losing his hearing in one ear. The performance was heralded by many critics as being the best of his career, though he was ultimately snubbed for a Best Actor nomination at the Oscars, perhaps because, as some awards insiders told The Hollywood Reporter, Redford appeared reluctant to campaign for the award. His final starring role was in David Lowery's acclaimed 2018 crime drama, The Old Man and the Gun, which earned Redford his 10th Golden Globe nomination, 11th if you count his 1994 Cecil B. DeMille Lifetime Achievement Award. As an actor, he told Vanity Fair at the time, "I think I've done it long enough. You don't want to overstay your time. The last film I'd done, Our Souls at Night, was a pretty heavy lift. It was a very dramatic love story. It was pretty sad. So the idea of this probably being the last thing I'm acting in just felt very right, because I could have fun, enjoy myself." Ironically, while most actors move west to hit it big, Redford, who was born and raised in Los Angeles, found himself moving east, eventually buying land in Utah, where his first wife, Lola Van Wagenen, was born and raised. The estate would be christened Sundance and became the home of his annual film festival, which celebrated its 41st anniversary in 2025. "I always distrusted California quite a bit because I grew up there," Redford told Rolling Stone in 1994. "It was not a place you went to because I was already there. It had no magic for me. I was born at the end of the rainbow, so I didn't see the rainbow." Born Charles Robert Redford Jr., Redford was the son and namesake of a milkman turned accountant. A self-described bad student, Redford suffered from a mild case of polio as a child after what he told Fresh Air was extreme exertion in the ocean. Though Redford's mother, Martha, had been advised not to have more children after Redford's difficult birth, she wanted a family so badly she got pregnant again, Redford told AARP in 2011. Martha had twin girls, both of whom died shortly after birth. A decade later, when Redford was in his late teens, his mother suffered a hemorrhage related to complications from the twins' birth and died. "It seemed so unfair," Redford told the organization, "but in an odd way, it freed me off to go on my own, which I'd wanted to do for a long time." Redford enrolled at the University of Colorado on a baseball scholarship. His attempt at serious academia was short-lived, as he preferred booze to books. But having witnessed the overdevelopment of his hometown, Redford's time in college was significant for another reason. "I went into the mountains and to the Sierras, worked at Yosemite National Park, and fell in love with nature that way. And I realized that nature was going to be a big part of my life," Redford told Fresh Air in 2013. "So I sought land elsewhere that I thought would be kept free of development." Post-college, Redford spent a year and a half in Europe in the 1950s, sketching, maturing, and engaging for the first time in politics. They challenged me about my politics, which didn't exist, Redford said of his time in Paris. It broadened my view of country, and when I went back, I questioned things, which led me into a certain amount of activism. According to AARP, Redford returned to Los Angeles long enough to meet his first wife, Lola Van Wagenen, a college student at the time, before moving to New York City, enrolling in art school, and at the behest of a teacher, transferring to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. Something clicked, Redford told AARP of those early days acting. It was the beginning of everything coming into focus with me. The actor started booking television parts, Perry Mason, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Route 66, The Twilight Zone, and stage roles before breaking out on Broadway in a production of Neil Simon's Barefoot in the Park. Redford starred opposite Jane Fonda in the 1967 screen adaptation. Before the end of the decade, Redford was cast at the behest of co-star Paul Newman in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, the iconic film that launched his star internationally. That was a gesture that I never forgot, and I felt that I really owed him after that, Redford told Fresh Air about Newman's decision to stand up to the studio to get Redford, then unknown, cast. And then he and I, in the course of that film, became really, really good friends. I've never had so much fun on a film as I have that one. Though he attained Hollywood leading man status, Redford said he never identified as being handsome and had a difficult time with the label and the limitations that came with it. I didn't grow up being told I was good looking, Robert told Rolling Stone in 1994. I was a freckle-faced kind of red-headed kid that people made fun of because my hair had so many colics. Suddenly, you're referred to as a glamorous figure, and it's flattering. Then shortly after that, you begin to realize that what's also coming with that is reduction. Then another kind of struggle begins. To distinguish himself as more than the Hollywood hunk, Redford took on darker, more textured characters, like in 1969's Downhill Racer, 1972's The Candidate, and 1972's Jeremiah Johnson. The actor also took on producing, launching a battle that he said lasted 3 years to get All the President's Men made. And in 1980, Redford added another title to his expanding resume by directing his first film, Ordinary People, which won 4 Oscars, including the Best Director statue for him and the Best Picture. He directed 8 more films, including A River Runs Through It, Quiz Show, and The Horse Whisperer, throughout his career. That movie was a turning point in my life, Redford told Rolling Stone, referring to Ordinary People. I was about to turn 40, so there was that decade coming to a close, as well as a full decade of work as an actor and producer. I was beginning to get frustrated with having to put so much body English on the films I was doing. I thought, I wish I could have total control of this situation. Why not just do it? Another major turning point came 5 years after the release of All the President's Men, when Redford founded the Sundance Institute to showcase the kind of sophisticated, nuanced, American-made films Hollywood had become less and less interested in making. The business changed and suddenly Hollywood became more centralized, Redford told Fresh Air. It was following the youth market. Technology was creating more chances for special effects, which would be more of a draw for the youth. And so Hollywood, which basically Hollywood follows the money, that's what it does, and so it was going in that direction. That led to the idea of, well, to keep this thing alive, Redford continued, explaining the inception of Sundance, because this is where new voices are going to be developing, or new films can be coming that are independent, that are more exciting and more humanistic and stuff like that. By 2016, the Sundance Film Festival had expanded to include over 120 feature-length films from more than 30 countries. The same year, by attracting upwards of 45,000 attendees, the festival also generated over $143 million in economic activity for the state of Utah. People say I've gone against Hollywood, Redford told The Telegraph in 2013, explaining his non-traditional trajectory. But I've tried to be independent within Hollywood, tried to be my own person. Once my career got going and I was able to act, I tried to take parts that were offbeat. In 2016, Barack Obama presented Redford with the Presidential Medal of Freedom, heralding the filmmaker's uncanny ability to forecast a major shift in Hollywood's movie-making landscape. Obama referred back to Redford's 1972 film, The Candidate. Redford's character famously asks his campaign manager the reflective and revealing question, "What do we do now?" Obama said during the ceremony. And like the man he played in that movie, Robert Redford had figured it out and applied his talent and charm to achieve success. We admire Bob not just for his remarkable acting, but for having figured out what to do next. Later on in his career, Redford relied on a turn of phrase he used to explain his offbeat interests in film, environment, politics, and the merging of the three, explaining how he was more interested in the gray area of complex individuals and issues in the country he grew up in. In an interview with Variety in 2013, Redford reiterated that, "As I grew up and went about my life, I think I just got more and more interested in that gray area where things are not so easily quantified. Now, thanks to the Sundance Film Festival and the Sundance Institute he founded, Redford is ensured that generations of filmmakers, actors, and audiences will continue on the exploration of the complicated and complex that he began, sharing the stories that, like this, don't fit neatly into any particular Hollywood stereotype." Redford is survived by his wife, Sybil Zagars, children, Shauna and Amy, and his two sons, Jamie and Scott, predeceased Redford, and seven grandchildren. Next up, an In Memoriam of Robert Redford by Monica Coviello on September 17th. The Sorrows of Robert Redford, How Personal Tragedy Clouded the Star's Life. Robert Redford died peacefully at age 89 at his home in the mountains outside Provo, Utah, surrounded by the affection of his large family. His life was an intense existence marked by both success and deep trauma. Born in Santa Monica on August 18, 1936, Redford grew up in a working-class neighborhood of Los Angeles. As a teenager, he was lively, not always diligent in school, but with a strong interest in drawing and painting. He contracted polio at age 11, and though the infection did not have long-term effects, it kept him bedridden for weeks. Redford's family life was also marked by early losses. When he was a child, his mother lost twins at birth, and when he was 18, his mother died at the age of 40, causing him great grief. "The regret that I had was that I couldn't thank her," Redford told Esquire in 2017. After being expelled from the University of Colorado due to alcoholism, Redford moved to Europe with his drawings and a dream of becoming an artist, living between Paris and Florence. Returning to the United States in 1957, still shaken and searching for direction, he met Lola Van Wagenen, whom he married in 1958, "to save my life," he later said. Van Wagenen, young and shy, encouraged him to study art and discover acting. Redford and Van Wagenen had four children. Their eldest son, Scott Anthony, died at just 2.5 months from sudden infant death syndrome. "I don't know. I was only 21. My wife was 20," he said later in an interview. "We were just starting our lives. Of course it was traumatic. Something like that doesn't get completely dismissed. It probably shows up in various small ways you're not even aware of." Shauna Redford, born in 1960, grew up between New York and Utah and built her life around art and family. In 1985, she married Eric Schlosser, author of Fast Food Nation, and had two children, Mika and Connor, who have taken creative and professional paths, continuing Redford's legacy of attention and artistic curiosity. Son James, born May 5, 1962, faced health challenges from a young age, including primary sclerosing cholangitis that led him to receive two liver transplants in 1993. His experience prompted him to found the James Redford Institute for Transplant Awareness, dedicated to raising awareness of organ donation and making documentaries on the subject. James married his wife Kyle in 1988, and together they had two children, Dylan and Lena. James died on October 16, 2020, from liver cancer, another immense grief for his father, Robert. Amy Redford, the youngest of the four, was born in 1970. Growing up between New York and Utah, she studied theater in San Francisco and chose a career in directing and film production. Amy has three daughters, Eden, born in 2008, and twins, born in 2010. Redford's marriage to Van Wagenen lasted 27 years, until 1985. Then Redford had a few casual relationships, including those with costume designer Kathy O'Rare, French supermodel Natalie Naud, actress Deborah Winger, and for 7 years, Brazilian actress Sonia Braga. In 1996, he met Sybil Zagers, a German painter who became his second wife in 2009. Redford later said that Zagers had given him a whole new life, combining his love of painting and his commitment to the environment. Today, his grandchildren, many of whom work in creative fields, carry on the legacy of Redford's values. Mika Schlosser works as a copywriter and illustrator in New York. Connor Schlosser is a producer in New York. Dylan Redford, James's son, is a filmmaker and collaborated with his grandfather. And Lena Hart Redford, James' second daughter, is an artist and filmmaker. All right, this is where current events and politics intersect. Late night TV isn't dying, it's being strangled. And we're not just talking about Jimmy Kimmel. In part one of a two-part series, nearly a dozen insiders explain how one of comedy's oldest genres is being strangled, starting with the chilling effect of Trump's culture wars. This is by Laura Bradley on September 19th. Last week tonight, senior editor Daniel O'Brien got a big laugh on stage at Sunday's Emmys when he accepted an award by saying he's grateful to write late-night political satire while it's still a type of show that's allowed to exist. Days later, ABC announced it was pulling Jimmy Kimmel Live off the air indefinitely. Though ABC's statement didn't include a rationale, the decision was made just hours after FCC Chairman Brendan Carr threatened any broadcasting companies that failed to take action against Kimmel in light of the remarks he'd made about MAGA's response to the murder of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. This is a very, very serious issue right now for Disney. We can do this the easy way or the hard way, Carr, a Donald Trump appointee, told right-wing journalist Benny Johnson. These companies can find ways to take action on Kimmel, or there's going to be additional work for the FCC ahead. In retrospect, O'Brien's joke feels bleakly prophetic. I question the sanity of anyone who does not believe this is a five-alarm fire, former Late Night and Last Week Tonight writer Greg Iwinski told Vanity Fair Wednesday night. ABC's decision came precisely 2 months after CBS unceremoniously canceled The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, making that announcement while its parent company, Paramount, waited for Carr's FCC to approve its merger with Skydance Media. But Iwinski sees one distinct difference between the two. They created a lot of false pretense with Stephen about money, he said. They didn't bother with the pretense this time. Late Show will finish its run in the spring, leaving CBS without any late-night programming for the first time in more than 30 years. Kimmel has not yet officially been fired, but if his show doesn't return, ABC will lose both its late-night presence and, arguably, its signature star. It's an ending that would have been unthinkable just 10 years ago, during the peak of the peak TV era, when networks and streaming platforms were greenlighting competitors to Colbert and Kimmel left and right. Back then, veterans Jay Leno, Jon Stewart, David Letterman, and Craig Ferguson all retired from their hosting gigs, leaving Jimmy Fallon, Seth Meyers, Trevor Noah, James Corden, and Colbert to take over their existing programs. New hosts like John Oliver, Larry Wilmore, Samantha Bee, Jordan Klepper, Hasan Minhaj, Busy Phillips, Lily Singh, and DeSeuss Nice, and The Kid Mero launched series in subsequent years that sought to redefine what late night could look like. A decade later, most of those new shows are gone. Tonight airs only 4 days per week. Late Night no longer has a house band. Millions of viewers still tune into these shows, and though more channels than ever before, but most of them are watching on social media, where studios still can't monetize audiences as well as they can on linear TV. Meanwhile, the political right has consolidated an immense amount of power, further threatening a genre that has spent the past decade critiquing conservatives. The outlook is bleak, prompting regular headlines about the death of late night. Yet nearly a dozen late night writers and industry experts who spoke with Vanity Fair for this piece, all, save Iwinski, before Kimmel's suspension, stopped short of proclaiming late night as good as gone. Audiences still love watching charismatic personalities interview interesting people and make jokes about the news, they say. For proof, look no further than TikTok and the celebrity video podcasts clogging feeds from X to Instagram. According to these sources, the problem is two-pronged. The first, more immediate issue is the chilling effect Trump has had on culture broadly, and late-night comedy specifically. Among the late-night writers, it's become tiresome to ask, is late-night dead? But Iwinski says if the genre is dead at this point, it is murder. This was the year that late-night was supposedly vastly unpopular, says Jill Twiss, who previously wrote for Last Week Tonight and The Amber Ruffin Show, and now writes for Roy Wood Jr.'s CNN comedy show, Have I Got News for You? But in reality, this was the year that Amber Ruffin was supposed to host the White House Correspondents' Dinner and got fired because they worried what she would say about Donald Trump. This is the year that, for whatever reason, Colbert, the number one show in late night, was canceled 2 days after he called out his own parent company. For late night writers, Colbert's cancellation seems to be the canary in the coal mine. Was it purely a financial decision, as Paramount claimed, or did the company's pending merger with Skydance put a thumb on the scale? A representative for Paramount Skydance Corporation told Vanity Fair that Skydance was not made aware of the Colbert decision before CBS announced it. A source familiar with the situation also acknowledged the unfavorable optics of canceling Late Show and said that Paramount Skydance's merger terms did not include Late Show's cancellation, only the financial settlement and the 2-year appointment of an ombudsman. Whatever the answer, the companies got their wish when the Trump administration approved the deal just a week after frequent Trump critic Colbert got the axe. I think it would be naive to talk about that cancellation on the terms that were laid out by Paramount and Skydance, says comedian Josh Gondelman, who previously wrote for Last Week Tonight and executive produced DeSeuss and Marrow. They need a merger approved by someone who has declared himself a personal enemy, essentially, of the host and of their flagship late-night show. Several writers also wonder when exactly profit became Late Show's primary business goal, when in the past, ratings have always been king. I've never heard about it talked about as, you've got to make us more money, Gondelman said, like it's a Walgreens location that's not bringing in enough cash. To him, canceling Late Show exemplifies the short-sighted slash-and-burn economics of the entertainment industry in the streaming era, like when Warner Brothers Discovery started canning its own movies for a tax break instead of releasing them. Networks and shows all have their own ways of handling money conversations, says former Full Frontal with Samantha Bee EP Allison Camillo. But as Full Frontal's network liaison, she spoke with representatives at TBS multiple times a day, something she sure happens at Late Show as well. If there was an open channel between Colbert's team and the network, I can't imagine that CBS would just blindside them like that, she says. But if they did, that's terrible. Only the outgoing decision makers at Paramount know for sure why Colbert got the boot, though Larry Wilmore, Colbert's friend and former Daily Show colleague, doubts the cancellation was a response to Colbert's anti-Trump stumping. If that was the case, Wilmore says, there's no way they allowed him to stay on another 9 months to keep the same thing. Instead, Wilmore believes this decision could have been in the works even before the merger offered a convenient opportunity to announce it publicly. That said, he adds, I'm still confused about a lot of it. The Kimmel suspension now feels like one more step in a broader pattern. ABC pulled Kimmel after Nexstar Media, which owns the large number of TV stations across the country, said that it would preempt Kimmel's program. And as CNBC reports, Nexstar is currently seeking FCC approval for a merger with the broadcast, digital media, and marketing company Tegna. Both CBS and ABC have already settled lawsuits with Trump, frustrating their rank-and-file staffers. According to various media reports, Skydance CEO David Ellison plans to hand CBS News to conservative founder of the Free Press, Barry Weiss. Last week, CBS announced that former Trump advisor Kenneth Weinstein will serve as the government-sanctioned truth arbiter that the network agreed to install as part of its merger agreement. A representative for CBS declined to comment. media companies aren't operating in a vacuum. American corporations and institutes from Target to Big Law have been working all year to placate Trump. After being appointed, Carr began launching formal reviews of nearly every major network, except, of course, for Fox. When CNN's Brian Stelter asked Carr for comment after ABC pulled Kimmel off the air, Carr reportedly responded by sending a GIF of two characters from The Office raising the roof in celebration. Late-nighter editor-at-large Bill Carter, who literally wrote the book on the genre, believes that this environment challenges the ability of all hosts to express themselves freely, a sentiment he shared with Vanity Fair even before Kimmel's cancellation. They have to zealously guard their free speech prerogatives, he said, but they cannot expose themselves to any kind of easy attack. Former Full Frontal executive producer and head writer Melinda Taub puts it another way. It's just really hard moment to tell the truth to power, she says, even in the form of dick jokes. There's a historical precedent for late night hosts getting yanked from the air for political reasons, a decision that still lives in infamy, at least for comedy writers. Back in 1969, CBS canceled The Smothers Brothers, a veritable hit with a huge audience, after both Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon complained about its content, specifically the hosts and their guests' criticism of the Vietnam War. Ever since then, Carter says there's been an implicit understanding that comedians can lampoon the president without fear, a sentiment echoed by multiple writers who spoke with Vanity Fair. From political cartoons about Abraham Lincoln to Leno's constant jokes about Bill Clinton, Carter says, this has been our history. You do not interfere with somebody's independent voice. They can make fun of you. The difference between us and kings was that we could do that. We could do that with impunity. But now, he says, we're to a point where that's apparently not the case. Especially since Trump does not seem content to stop with Kimmel and Colbert. Quote, the ratings challenge Jimmy Kimmel show is canceled, the president wrote incorrectly on Truth Social Wednesday, apparently so elated he couldn't resist posting even as he was honored at a state dinner with King Charles and Queen Camilla. According to Bloomberg reporter Lucas Shaw, Kimmel will be off the air until at least Monday. His show has not been formally canceled. Trump continued ominously, that leaves Jimmy and Seth, two total losers on fake news NBC, referring to Fallon and Myers. Trump and TV have long had a symbiotic relationship. Now, says Iwinski, a man who's been obsessed with television his entire life finally has browbeat all three branches of government into a place where he can pick what's on TV, and that's what he's doing. Remember, this is part one of a two-part series, and I'll bring you the second part next week. One more article on the Jimmy Kimmel topic. Late night rallies behind Jimmy Kimmel. Tonight, we are all Jimmy Kimmel. In the wake of Kimmel's indefinite suspension from ABC, late night hosts such as Stephen Colbert, Jon Stewart, and Seth Meyers took to their programs to show support for Kimmel and lament the latest attack on free speech. This is by Chris Murphy on September 19th. Late night television may be under attack, but its hosts are sticking together. On Wednesday evening, ABC announced that it was pulling Jimmy Kimmel's long-running late-night series, Jimmy Kimmel Live, off the air following comments Kimmel made about the murder of Charlie Kirk and pressure from FCC Chair Brendan Carr. One day after Kimmel's immediate and indefinite suspension, late-night hosts including Stephen Colbert, Jon Stewart, and Seth Meyers took to their desks and spoke about the blatant attack on free speech. I'm going to take this moment to remind you that you're listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We're currently reading from vanityfair.com, and we are in the middle of an article about the other late night hosts rallying around Jimmy Kimmel. Let's continue. Colbert knows a thing or two about being silenced by a network. Earlier this summer, Paramount abruptly announced that it was canceling his Emmy-winning CBS Late Night Show. The Late Show with Stephen Colbert after Colbert's contract expires in May. The decision came as Paramount, CBS's parent company, was waiting for government approval for an $8 billion merger with media conglomerate Skydance. At the time, Kimmel and other late-night hosts rallied around Colbert, appearing together on his show and calling out CBS and Paramount for potentially kowtowing to President Donald Trump, who had made his ire for Colbert and his comedy well known. Now it was time for Colbert to return the favor. "Tonight, we are all Jimmy Kimmel," said Colbert to open his monologue. Yesterday, after threats from the FCC chair, ABC yanked Kimmel off the air indefinitely. "That is blatant censorship," said Colbert. He then reminded the audience about Trump's decision in his first week of his presidency to rename the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. "Sure, seems harmless, but with an autocrat, you cannot give an inch," said Colbert to loud cheers from the studio audience. "And if ABC thinks this is going to satisfy the regime, they are woefully naive. And clearly, they've never read the book, If You Give a Mouse a Kimmel." Colbert then addressed Kimmel directly, saying he stands with the comedian and his staff amid the suspension, before joking that the brouhaha surrounding Kimmel has overshadowed The Late Show's recent Emmy win for Outstanding Talk Series. "You couldn't let me enjoy this for like 1 week? Come on," said Colbert, who was holding his Emmy. On The Daily Show, host Jon Stewart also showed his support for Kimmel, albeit in a more tongue-in-cheek way. "It's your all-new government-approved Daily Show with your patriotic host Jon Stewart," a voiceover announced before panning to a nervous Stewart. "We have another fun, hilarious, administration-compliant show," said the seemingly spooked Stewart. Stewart then admonished the crowd for laughing and threatening to blow his cover while he praised Trump through visibly clenched teeth. "Now, some naysayers may argue that this administration's speech concerns are merely a cynical ploy, a thin gruel of a ruse, a smokescreen to obscure an unprecedented consolidation of power and unitary intimidation. Principleless and coldly antithetical to any experiment in a constitutional republic governance," said Stewart. "Some people would say that. Not me, though. I think it's great." Over on The Tonight Show, Jimmy Fallon kept his remarks about the other late-night Jimmy rather brief. Jimmy Kimmel was suspended by ABC after receiving pressure from the FCC, leaving everyone thinking, "WTF," said Fallon at the top of his monologue. "This morning I woke up to 100 texts from my dad being like, 'I'm sorry they canceled your show,'" Fallon quipped. He then took on a more serious tone and expressed his genuine confusion with the situation and his admiration for his other Jimmy. "But to be honest with you all, I don't know what's going on, and no one does. But I do know Jimmy Kimmel, and he's a decent, funny, and loving guy, and I hope he comes back." Fallon's NBC counterpart, Seth Meyers, devoted an entire late-night segment entitled "A Closer Look" to Kimmel and Trump's crackdown on free speech. "I just want to say before we get started here that I've always admired and respected Mr. Trump," said Meyers, to laughter from the audience. "I've always believed he was, no, a visionary, an innovator, a great president, an even better golfer. And if you've never seen me say anything negative about him, that's just AI." He eventually turned his attention directly to Kimmel. "And may I just say, it is a privilege and an honor to call Jimmy Kimmel my friend in the same way that it's a privilege and honor to do this show every night," said Meyers. "I wake up every day, I count my blessings that I live in a country that at least purports to value freedom of speech, and we're going to keep doing our show the way we've always done it, with enthusiasm and integrity." We're going to turn to the talk of the week, which is Charlie Kirk. This is a commentary by Ta-Nehisi Coates on September 16th. "Charlie Kirk redeemed. A political class finds its lost cause." Before he was killed last week, Charlie Kirk left a helpful compendium of words, one that would greatly aid those who sought to understand his legacy and import. It's somewhat difficult to match these words with the manner in which Kirk is presently being memorialized in mainstream discourse. New York Times columnist Ezra Klein dubbed Kirk one of the era's most effective practitioners of persuasion and a man who was practicing politics in exactly the right way. California Governor Gavin Newsom hailed Kirk's passion and commitment to debate, advising us to continue Kirk's work by engaging with each other across ideology through spirited discourse. Atlantic writer Sally Jenkins saluted Kirk, claiming he argued with civility and asserting that his death was a significant loss for those who believe engagement can help bridge disagreements. The mentions of debate and engagement are references to Kirk's campus tours, during which he visited various colleges to take on whoever come may. That this aspect of Kirk's work would be so attractive to writers and politicians is understandable. There is, after all, a pervasive worry among the political class that college students, ensconced in their own bubbles, could use a bit of shock therapy from a man unconcerned with preferred pronouns, trigger warnings, and the humanity of Palestinians. But it also shows how the political class's obsession with universities blinds it to everything else. And the everything else of Kirk's politics amounted to little more than a loathing of those whose mere existence provoked his ire. It's not just, for instance, that Kirk held disagreeable views, that he was pro-life, that he believed in public executions, or that he rejected the separation of church and state. It's that Kirk reveled in open bigotry. Indeed, claims of Kirk's civility are tough to square with his penchant for demanding members of the LGBTQ plus community as freaks and referring to trans people with the slur tranny. Faced with the prospect of a Kamala Harris presidency, Kirk told his audience that the threat had to be averted because Harris wanted to kidnap your child via the trans agenda. Garden variety transphobia is sadly unremarkable, but Kirk was a master of folding seemingly discordant bigotries into each other, as when he defined the American way of life as marriage, homeownership, and child rearing free of the lesbian, gay, transgender garbage in their school, adding that he did not want his kids to have to hear the Muslim call to prayer 5 times a day. The American way of life was Christendom, Kirk claimed, and Islam, the sword the left is using to slit the throat of America, was antithetical to that. Large, dedicated Islamic areas were a threat to America, Kirk asserted, and New York mayoral candidate Zoran Mamdani was a Mohammedan, with Kirk opposing that anyone trying to see Mohammedism take over the West would love to have a New York, a prior Anglo center, under Mohammedan rule. Kirk habitually railed against black crime, claiming that prowling blacks go around for fun to target white people. He repeated the rape accusations against Yusuf Salam, a member of the exonerated Central Park Five, who is now a New York City councilman, calling him a disgusting pig who had gotten away with gang rape. Whatever distaste Kirk held for blacks was multiplied when he turned to those from Haiti. Haiti was, by Kirk's lights, a country infested with demonic voodoo, whose migrants were raping your women and hunting you down at night. These Haitians, as well as undocumented immigrants from other countries, were having a field day, per Kirk, and coming for your daughter next. The only hope was Donald Trump, who had to prevail, lest Haitians become your masters. The point of this so-called mastery was as familiar as it was conspiratorial. Great replacement. There was an anti-white agenda, Kirk howled, one that sought to make the country more like the third world. The southern border was the dumping ground of the planet, he claimed, and a magnet for the rapists, the thugs, the murderers, fighting-age males. They're coming from across the world, from China, from Russia, from Middle Eastern countries, he said, and they're coming in, and they're coming in, and they're coming in, and they're coming in. You can probably imagine where this line of thinking eventually went. Jewish donors, Kirk claimed, were the number one funding mechanism of radical open-border, neoliberal, quasi-Marxist policies, cultural institutions, and nonprofits. Indeed, the philosophical foundation of anti-whiteness has been largely financed by Jewish donors in the country. Kirk's bigotry was not personal, but extended to the institution he founded, Turning Point USA. Crystal Clanton, the group's former national field director, once texted a fellow Turning Point employee, "I hate black people. Like, fuck them all. I hate blacks. End of story." One of the group's advisors, Rip McIntosh, once published a newsletter featuring an essay from a pseudonymous writer that said blacks had become socially incompatible with other races and that black culture was an unfixable and crime-ridden mess. In 2022, after 3 black football players were killed at another college, Meg Miller, president of Turning Point's chapter at the University of Missouri, joked, quote-unquote joked, in a social media message, "If they would have killed 4 more, N-words, we would have had the whole week off." Kirk subscribed to some of the most disreputable and harmful beliefs that this country has ever known, but it is still chilling to think that those beliefs would be silenced by a gunshot. The tragedy is personal. Kirk was robbed of his life, and his children and family will forever live with the knowledge that a visual record of that robbery is just an internet search away. And the tragedy is national. Political violence ends conversation and invites war. Its rejection is paramount to a functioning democracy and a free society. Political violence is a virus, Klein noted. This assertion is true. It's also at odds with Kirk's own words. It's not that Kirk merely, as Klein put it, defended the Second Amendment. It's that Kirk endorsed hurting people to advance his preferred policy outcomes. In 2022, when Kirk was frustrated, for instance, by the presence of Leah Thomas on the University of Pennsylvania women's swim team, Kirk did not call for spirited discourse. Instead, while discussing a recent championship tournament, he said he would have liked to have seen a group of fathers descend from the stands, forming a line in front of Leah Thomas and saying, "Hey, tough guy, you want to get in the pool? Because you're going to have to come through us." Mere weeks before his death, Kirk reveled in Trump's deployment of federal troops to D.C. "Shock and awe, force," he wrote, "we're taking our country back from these cockroaches." And in 2023, Kirk told his audience that then-President Joe Biden was a corrupt tyrant who should be put in prison and/or given the death penalty for his crimes against America. What are we to make of a man who called for the execution of the American president and then was executed himself? What are we to make of an NFL that on one hand encourages us to end racism and on the other urges us to commemorate an unreconstructed white supremacist? And what of the writers, the thinkers, and the pundits who cannot separate the great crime of Kirk's death from the malignancy of his public life? Can they truly be so ignorant to the words of a man they have so rushed to memorialize? I don't know. But the most telling detail in Klein's column was that, for all his praise, there was not a single word in the piece from Kirk himself. More than a century and a half ago, this country ignored the explicit words of men who sought to raise an empire of slavery. It subsequently transformed those men into gallant knights who sought only to preserve their beloved Camelot. There was a fatigue in certain quarters with Reconstruction, which is to say multiracial democracy, and a desire for reunion to make America great again. Thus, in the late 19th century and much of the 20th, this country's most storied intellectuals transfigured hate mongers into heroes and ignored their words, just as right now some are ignoring Kirk's. Words are not violence, nor are they powerless. Burying the truth of the Confederacy, rewriting its aims and ideas, and ignoring its animating words allowed for the terrorization of the black population, the imposition of apartheid, and the destruction of democracy. The rewriting and the ignoring were done not just by Confederates, but also by putative allies for whom the reduction of black people to serfdom was the unfortunate price of white unity. The import of this history has never been clearer than in this moment when the hard question must be asked. If you would look away from the words of Charlie Kirk, from what else would you look away? Our next article. This is going to radicalize millions of Americans. Young MAGA plots a future after Charlie Kirk. This is by Olivia Empson on September 17th. Charlie Kirk's killing on a Utah University campus last Wednesday has left a generation of conservatives without a leader, activists in the movement tell Vanity Fair. With his extensive online presence and close relationship to the White House, Kirk was a standard bearer for young people coming to politics for the first time, and the network he created served as a haven for conservatives who felt out of sync with their liberal peers. In the aftermath of his death, young MAGA activists are grappling with what comes next. Charlie wasn't just my boss, he was my mentor, my friend, and in many ways like an older brother, 23-year-old Mikey McCoy, Kirk's former chief of staff, tells Vanity Fair. McCoy and his wife, 25-year-old Elizabeth, the administrative events director at Turning Point USA, the organization Kirk founded at 18, will play central roles in his commemorations going forward. Kirk's widow, Erica, thanked McCoy by name in her live-streamed address. The couple stood by as Kirk's casket was escorted onto Air Force Two and will no doubt be in the front row at his public memorial in Glendale, Arizona this Sunday, where McCoy will be delivering a brief speech. "We are no longer the silent majority," Elizabeth says, speaking to how the shooting has emboldened young conservatives in their political ambition. "Anyone who thinks this will silence us clearly does not understand who we are and what we stand for." Even though so much of the young MAGA community is online, live events are a mainstay of this type of activism. They help generate content that can be repackaged for social media, allowing creators to curate short viral moments and draw in a new audience. The lax security at Utah Valley University has raised questions about what type of protection should be in place for such events going forward. Gabe Saint, the 23-year-old president of the Turning Point chapter at the University of Wyoming, tells Vanity Fair that he will continue to do live speaking events. He already held one Monday evening in Casper, Wyoming, and says he's organized a public address on his campus for Friday night. "Overall, we're not nervous," he confirms. "God is with us." Saint tells me that he's taking his guidance from Kirk's wife, Erica. "She gave us our marching orders when she addressed the nation, and like she said, we know what to do as TPUSA students," Saint says. "We will obviously take further precautions, but our greatest tool is our faith that God will protect us in our fight for all our people, including our enemies." "He was an icon for my generation," Jamie Lee Franklin, a 27-year-old former White House staffer who founded the online right-wing women's lifestyle magazine, The Conservator, says. Franklin believes the young MAGA community needs to continue to hold events across the country in even greater volumes. To honor Kirk's memory, her site has taken down the paywall on a story about him that was published in January. "Charlie would never want this movement to end with him," Franklin says. "The best way to honor his legacy is to press forward with even greater resolve, carrying out his mission and fighting for the future of our nation harder than ever before." Several memorials took place on college campuses earlier this week, and Wednesday we will see a rally at the University of Alabama hosted by C.J. Pearson, the co-chair of the Republican National Committee Youth Advisory Council, and featuring Savannah Chrisley, the reality TV star whose parents were pardoned by Trump following a controversial fraud case. Emily Wilson, a conservative influencer who goes by Emily Saves America to her more than 500,000 Instagram followers, admits that she too will likely have to get security for events moving forward, but says that this has not deterred her from using her platform. Wilson went viral last year after appearing on a podcast with Dean Withers and suggesting that slavery, like abortion, could be a state-by-state issue. Wilson said, "If everyone in the state wants it, go ahead. What do I give a shit?" Now she tells Vanity Fair that Kirk's killing is like MLK or JFK to us, saying, "If anything, this has pushed me extremely further in my beliefs." Socially, politically, Republicans and conservatives are going to be pissed, says Lou Holly, a 30-year-old content creator who makes arguably rage-baity YouTube, TikTok, and Instagram videos. In a recent post, he dismissed free speech concerns about Trump's executive order directing the prosecution of those who burn the flag. "If the only way you know how to express the way that you're feeling is by burning an American flag, then you're probably not smart enough to be protesting anyways." One of Holly's highest performing videos has racked up more than 17 million views. "I think a lot of Republicans are going to stop holding their punches because they just lost a friend," he says. Holly shares that he was previously reluctant to appear on conservative networks and at public events after experiencing aggression just from posting online, fearing what might pretend. "The killing, however, has changed his mind. This tragedy has shown me I can't rely on others to do the hard things for me," he explains. "It's up to me to be brave enough to stand on the front lines and fight for what I know is right." While it's not clear who will emerge as the new face of young conservatism, Kirk's death has added fresh fuel to the Youth MAGA mission and encouraged members of the movement more than ever, to not be silent about their political beliefs. "He's now like a martyr to us, I guess," Wilson said. "I think this is going to radicalize millions of Americans." We'll see if we have time for this whole article. This is how Erica Kirk rose to power by Julie Miller on September 19th. This April, Erica Kirk was taping an episode of her Christian podcast, Midweek Rise Up. Her special guest that day was her husband of 4 years, Charlie, the conservative wunderkind who helped Donald Trump secure the youth vote in the 2024 election, an Arizona beauty pageant winner with flaxen waist-length hair, blue eyes, and a Bible-based streetwear brand called Proclaim, who bore Charlie two blonde children. The 36-year-old was alluring in her embodiment of the conservative ideals he promoted on college tours. "I love how much he loves this country," she captioned her 4th of July Instagram this year. She posted a video montage of her handsome husband on the beach in a suit playing with their blonde children in matching American flag-themed clothing. Another frame depicted Erica gazing up at her husband adoringly, a modern-day Nancy Reagan. Kirk did not immediately respond to a request for an interview. As far as MAGA wags go, she was as devoted to her husband's political career as Melania Trump has appeared to be disinterested in hers. Kirk seems comfortable speaking at rallies and into a mic a la Lara Trump, who segued her marriage with Donald Trump's son Eric into a Fox program that premiered earlier this year. Whereas Lara seemed independent-minded, her series is titled My View with Lara Trump, Erica has made it clear that, in alignment with her Christian values, wives serve their husbands. The title of Erica's podcast that day summed it up: submission is not a dirty word. Speaking from opposite desks, with framed photos of Donald Trump peering over their shoulders on either side, they spoke about homeschooling, dating apps, and Erica's greatest value, being in the home. She and her husband repeated the refrain often: women shouldn't pursue their own careers while raising children. Erica previously worked as a real estate agent with Corcoran in New York, and her LinkedIn page has identified her as an agency-represented model and casting director for various TV networks. For the purposes of their outward messaging, Erica seemed to be broadcasting from the podcast studio because of a technicality. She was promoting his career. And yet, she has also acted as Kirk's foil, a devil's advocate in sheep's clothing. After Charlie proclaimed, "It's easy to not be poor if you are a man," Erica asked him to consider student debt. He did briefly. "If someone couldn't afford an education," Charlie said, "he shouldn't have gone to college." When Charlie posited that a man who wanted to become a stay-at-home dad was probably gay, Erica stepped in to recall her time with her own stay-at-home dad as really sweet and really special. When Charlie declared that motherhood comes so naturally to women that they make very good mothers with almost no, like, training, Erica countered that women need to want to become mothers first, or else they're going to stick their kid in front of Cocomelon. A former Miss Arizona USA who established her own nonprofit as a teenager, Erica was a natural public speaker, one of the reasons, Charlie joked, he married her. During last year's annual Turning Point event, America Fest, Charlie looked to Erica to answer the question of how the conservative movement could win back young women and sell them on this idea of traditional practices and roles. He acknowledged his wife, who was wearing a teal turtleneck dress and silver heels. Erica is the young woman outreach part of this. Erica's public role shifted dramatically and tragically on September 10th when her husband was assassinated while speaking to college students in Utah. Just 2 days later, Erica assumed a new mantle at Turning Point USA, the nonprofit Charlie founded in 2012. From a lectern set up beside the chair where her husband had hosted his podcast and appeared on hers, she vowed, "The movement my husband built will not die. It won't. I refuse to let that happen." And then on Wednesday, Erica was officially named the new CEO and chair of the board of Turning Point USA. "This is what he wanted in the event of his death," the organization said in the announcement on X. "The woman who preached about subservience to her husband has become his organization's new leader." Emerging from her husband's shadow, Erica is poised to become a more visible face of the anti-feminism movement along the likes of Phyllis Schlafly, Alex Clark, Candace Owens, and Riley Gaines, the last three of whom have been or currently are affiliated with Turning Point USA. During a recent YouTube tribute to her over 5 million subscribers, Owens recalled her days working alongside Charlie, Charlie's work rule, never say no to Fox News, and her hand in plotting Charlie's marriage proposal to Erica. The key, she joked, was convincing Erica that Kirk was a much better surname than the one she'd been born with, which was Francois. In a screenshot Owens shared of their text exchange, Charlie joked that Erica's surname sounded like he was sneezing and forecasted that they were going to be the power couple of the century. Owens joked, "We broke Erica down." Before entering the conservative politics Thunderdome by marrying Charlie in 2021, Erica was already a public figure, albeit on a smaller scale. After growing up a tomboy in a tight-knit Catholic family, she won the 2012 Miss Arizona USA title, earning her local press coverage and the opportunity to talk about her philanthropy. She catches her eye with her stunning looks and then captures your heart with her warmth and character, the pageant's then-executive producer, Britt Boise, gushed to the Arizona Foothills magazine. Erica's pageant career ended soon after, following her unsuccessful run at the 2012 Miss USA, a pageant in the Miss Universe organization that was at that point co-owned by Donald Trump, according to The New Yorker. Her next public appearance came in 2019 when she appeared on Bravo as a religious love interest of the Summer House character Jordan Verroy. Bravo's website describes him as a Southern gentleman, a model, and the founder of an app. During her brief screen time on a date with him, she ordered a Chardonnay, smiled through an awkward string of his questions, and then shot down his romantic advances by telling him she just wanted to be friends. It was a short but savage cameo, a contrast to the cross-legged politician's wife performances she gave at conservative rallies. In a 2019 Instagram post, Erica said she'd been offered a gig on the show as well as various TV show opportunities, but that she passed on these entertainment career options in pursuit of her master's degree at Christian Liberty University. By that point, she had already found love behind the scenes with Charlie, who introduced himself to her at the Turning Point office and DM'd her on Instagram in 2018. During their first dinner at Bill's Bar and Burgers in Manhattan, Erica thought she was interviewing for a job, but 15 minutes into the sit-down, Charlie realized he could not hire her because he wanted to date her. In the days after Charlie's death, Erica shared a video of her late husband describing their meet-cute to their 3-year-old daughter at the same restaurant. They also share a 1-year-old son. Then I realized that Mama was beautiful and smart and elegant and Christ-like, so I said, "Forget this job interview, I want to date you," Charlie said. Erica captioned it, "My favorite love story." Brittany Hugo Bloom, the conservative co-founder of Evie magazine, shared the meet-cute on her ex profile. They were soulmates. By the end of 2018, Erica launched her Proclaim Christian streetwear brand, which now sells baby blankets, adult clothing, luggage tags, leather bookmarks, engraved straws, beanies, and socks. Charlie appeared alongside his wife in the marketing photos for some of the merchandise, as well as the promotional art for her podcast, a blurring of their personal and professional lives that was present from the start. Turning Point USA not only backed Trump during his 2020 and 2024 elections, it also sponsored their 2021 wedding reception, according to the AP. In the days since Kirk's assassination, the Trump administration has treated him like a national hero, with Vice President J.D. Vance, his wife Usha, and Air Force Two deployed to escort the casket to Arizona. Erica, mourning in all black and sunglasses, was photographed clutching the second lady's hand as she exited the plane. The Turning Point USA's statement announcing Erica as her husband's successor made it clear she would be continuing his mission. "We will not surrender or kneel before evil," board members said. "We will carry on." This brings us to the end of our time together here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith, your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you so much for tuning in. I invite you to join me next week for another full hour of stories from VanityFair.com. Thanks for listening, and have a great week, everybody.